Oscar. Mm-hmm. So anyways, I'm sitting here with Oscar, who I met when I once upon a time worked at Starbucks. I don't know why I have a hard time admitting the people I worked with. How is that for you?
Gosh, I think it's hard because someone always has like a story. Like, oh, there was this one time in Starbucks where this happened. So I don't like telling people because they always have a story to tell you.
Well, and I'm not a big coffee drinker. So I'm like, oh, I could make your drink, but yeah, I don't want to drink it.
I don't know if it's good.
Yeah, I met Oscar up north and we happen to both live in Pasadena.
Yeah.
Well, I live when I'm here, so.
And then I came and followed her in pursuit of happiness. No.
So, Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do for a living?
I do what people call a noble job, is what I get all the time. I'm a social worker.
So, I'll be honest, like, you know, from having conversations with you, I've gotten to know what that means more, but usually it's like on TV shows or movies. Social workers are always in the realm of hospital work, mm-hmm. and usually we don't know who their parents are, who they belong to, and then it's always, like, call the social worker.
Mm-hmm.
That was my extent for the longest time of what a social worker is. How accurate or not accurate is that?
That is, I want to say, 25% accurate. There is 75%. There's other things that we do, which is, like, the bulk of our work, and that happens to be, like, one specialty of it.
Do you actually find who they belong to? Or
the child?
Yeah, so if there's a patient and they're like, they're unconscious, and we're like, we don't know who they belong to, mm-hmm. is that what you do?
Well, I don't work in a hospital setting right now, mm-hmm. but that could be, you can assist to help out, to find out who this person is. You can help out, you know, but that is not the your main role. Your main role in hospitals is more like finding resources for families, helping them cope with, let's say, a family member was diagnosed with a terminal illness, helping them adapt to that change, adjust to that change, or even help them understand what it means. Because a lot of our work is teaching. Many people may not understand what is really happening because they have a lot of preconceived notions of everything.
Do social workers, though, work with people from any economic background? Because I think the other thing, too, is that mm-hmm. there's the assumption that social workers only work with people that come from the lower economic background.
You know, and it's true. I'm not sure how accurate this is, but I feel that we generally start off with a lower SES, which stands for a social economic status. We tend to start off with you know, working with that population. But if we choose to, we could go into private practice because we could obtain our license to be a clinical therapist. And then we can open up our own private practice. And then we could either accept insurance or we could just only cash only. And that's when you're helping more people with more money and resources at that point.
Gotcha. So, to start, I guess, from ground zero, you are a social worker, and so you don't work in the hospital.
Mm-mm.
Where do you work, and how do you work?
I work as a therapist for a substance abuse treatment program, and I essentially, the clients first come in, so in crisis, so I help to normalize them or bring them down to like a stable baseline is what we call it, stabilize, so that I can understand really what's going on. So with them right now, it's finding out why they're using, how much, how frequent, trying to explore, you know, what are their triggers, trying to explore, are you in danger of hurting yourself? Are you in danger of being hurt by someone? So it's really, we're trying to rule out everything. In the first session, I'm trying to find out who you are, get you to trust me, and to know that I'm going to help you. But at the same time, we're keeping all these things in mind in terms of the safety of the client and to make sure that they feel like they can actually be honest and authentic with you. So my work is more, I would say, clinical than what you would see in television.
So how does somebody get into that program that you're working in?
In, like, substance abuse?
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, what I've seen people do is there are many people who have been in recovery themselves who go into a recovery program, for example, and they'll start off being counselors, and then they start getting their certification to be a counselor, and then they start moving up. If you want to be like a therapist for a substance abuse program, my best suggestion is to get your background in like sociology, psychology, something along those realms to understand why people function the way that they do, but to not just importantly focus on behavior, but to understand like their entire social system, to see like what makes them them. and to learn how to be really empathetic, non-judgmental, because you'll hear a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. So you have to make sure that even if you get triggered yourself, that you're there for the client. So the best way to get into it, I would say, is study some of those, I would say majors, or even like philosophy would be good. Criminology would be another great one. And then start going into getting certifications in like substance abuse, and then volunteering at these like type of agencies. Get the experience, because a lot of times these are a very vulnerable population, and it's hard to get in without having a background experience in that particular population.
So what was your route to getting into this line of work?
Well, originally I'd worked a lot with students in undergrad. I was like a residential advisor, an RA as they called us, the narcs, the ones who like stop the parties, but that's not what we did. And so I started that route doing more crisis intervention is what we called it. You know, people are not getting along in the dorms, or people are coming out as gay or have eating disorders. You know, people are leaving the comfort of their home. So now they're here and a lot of things are surfacing. So that's how I began. And gradually, when I went to graduate school to get my master's in social work, I was interning in two different places, one for my first year, one for my second year. And my second year happened to be working with Vietnam veterans at a residential program, because they were homeless, and a lot of them have substance abuse problems. So I went in as a therapist to help out these clients to see, you know, how I can help them to get back on their feet and to see if I can alleviate some of their stressors. And then from there is where I landed my job now, because I had previous experience of working with a very, very vulnerable population in substance abuse.
Now, these programs that you're working with, are these state-funded programs? Are these independent programs? What are they?
They all vary. The one that I entered in, it was at Salvation Army. So that, I believe that one is more of a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. But it was located at the VA. So it was almost like a balance of federal.
That's weird.
Isn't it? Like, it was just a building.
You think, like, the VA would have their own?
And they do. And they have their...
Then they also house them within their building?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah. There's just... Because the Salvation Army's always worked with veterans, mm-hmm. but they happen to be nonprofit. So I guess it's just they're renting out a space, if you will, at the VA. Because that's... If you think about it, it makes perfect sense. That's where the vets are going. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, the perfect way to, you know, when one program for the VA is already full, it's a great way to have an extra spot and more resources. So it was a great idea on their part.
Now, have you always wanted to be a social worker?
No.
What did you originally want to be?
I was going to be a lawyer.
A lawyer?
Yeah.
I don't even think I knew that. When did you think you wanted to be that?
You know, ever since I was in high school, I was like devoted that I was going to be going into politics or going into some form of law practice.
Why was that though? Did you grow up with that? Or,
you know, when I was in high school, I was really involved with a lot of student organizations that really focused on student advocacy, trying to help those who have less resources, injustices. In a way, I was lying to myself. I did everything a social worker did, but in myself, I was like, no, this is politics.
Gotcha.
You know, so then I really started to think I was going to go into law, you know, and I started protesting a lot in high school for many reasons, like, you know, for the Latino community to get more resources, for the LGBT community. And I just became this huge advocate in high school that when I transitioned to undergrad, I continued to pursue that and study politics. And I was really disheartened to see the corruption that lies within politics and how I would be, it would be difficult for me to help out people in the way that I wanted to help out.
What's neat, though, it sounds like the reason why you wanted to get into politics is what you're actually doing now mm-hmm. in your social work.
Exactly. I'm myself helping people with these injustices, to deal with them, to adjust to them, to cope with them. Whereas before, I was thinking, like, macro. I was thinking mm-hmm. program development. I was thinking, you know, community resources and so forth, which all intersect with social work. But I also was very non-familiar with, you know, or ambivalent, I would say, about social work. I didn't know that's what social workers did, because I had the same perception that you had, that we either worked with children, foster care, or that we just, you know, print out resources, and that's all that we did, and we're all bitter and jaded. Mm-hmm. And that's all that I knew. But in reality, there are so many commonalities between social work and being in politics. You can do micro or macro or meso. I mean, it just depends how you use your discipline.
Yeah, so many times I'd be watching movies and I'd be rooting against, like, the social worker, because you'd be like, no, you don't want those kids to go with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, since I started talking to you, I was like, wow, that's not exactly how it really is. So if I could talk to your five-year-old self and ask you what you wanted to be when you grew up, what would you have said?
Oh, wow. When I was five, I really, really, I think I had, like, the all-American dream of being a firefighter. You know, I really did.
But was that just about being on the big truck and wearing a cool hat? Like,
I really did not know much about anything when I was younger because my parents are from a different country. So my knowledge was very limited, as was theirs. So my exposure was what I saw on television, what I was socialized by the media. So all I knew was, oh, you know, how glorious it is to be a cop or how to be a firefighter. So then I kind of fell for that, you know, that these are like respected professions, or to be a doctor, but little do you ever hear about being a social worker.
Well, that's what I was asking. Do you feel like you are in a respected profession?
I think I am amongst my own group of social workers, like my friends and colleagues.
How about the average person walking down the street? Do you think they respect what you do?
No.
Well, because why not?
Because I think that they don't understand what it is that I do.
Have you come across, like, what they think you're doing?
Yeah, most of the time, this is the reaction that we get, and it's a social work joke that we always have. You know, it's like, for example, what do you do?
What's your profession? You're asking me?
Yeah, I'm asking you.
I'm a producer.
Oh, so most people are like, oh my god, that's awesome, you produce movies, and...
And then you go, well, kind of, but it's a little more like, yeah.
Right, so they're more enthusiastic about your response. Yeah. Whereas for us, I'm a social worker, this is what we hear. Ooh. I'm so sorry. We hear that a lot.
Well, that sounds like more sympathetic.
Yeah, or what they also say sometimes, it's, well, it's a very noble job. You know, I could never do that. I could never work with kids when I don't work with kids.
So they don't know what you're really doing.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have a certain community or populace that you work with?
Right now, I'm working with... It's a very detailed population. So I'm working a lot with the Latino community who identifies as either gay, bisexual, or as we call it, MSM, which stands for men who have sex with men. And that term really just means men who engage in relationships or sexual conduct with another male but may not identify as gay or bisexual. So like, there's no label that really fits them.
Gotcha.
So I work with that population as well, which that's one component of it. But since I'm working in substance abuse, there's also, like, the substance abuse element component and HIV as well. Because since people use drugs, they're in higher risk of contracting something. So we do a lot of HIV work as well.
You're interacting with these people in all these stories all the time. Does it change how you interact with the drinking or drugs in your life?
Yeah, it really helps me to really think about if I ever have a glass of wine. It makes me nervous sometimes to be like, oh my god, am I having too much? It's a glass. It's once a week. Oh my god, but that's how they started. You know, and sometimes in the beginning, that's how I thought. But now, I'm very much, you know, okay with just being honest with myself. And, you know, hearing the stories of these people and just taking them as their reality and not my reality. If it happens to be my reality, then of course I'm going to do something about it because I'm more educated about what it is that I may be going through. But, you know, a lot of us social workers were encouraged to go to therapy as well, but many of us don't go to therapy because there's also stigma attached to that. So, like, I go to therapy as well. I have a therapist. And I think that helps me treat my clients with the utmost respect, but then also to check myself to make sure that I'm not being, that I'm not being, like, a hypocrite, or that my own projections of the world are not being set on them. So it really helps me to check myself.
Now, is that a personal decision, or is that a work thing?
Personal decision.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
But now, do you go to somebody who's through your work, or is it somebody completely separate?
Completely different. Yeah.
What made you come to that decision?
Well, at first, I was very apprehensive about that decision, but I have a clinical supervisor who, of course, since I'm not licensed yet, they supervise my work to make sure that everything I do is ethical. And when she was talking to me and she said, look, sometimes when we hear about people's problems and so forth, it's really easy for us sometimes to get stressed out, become jaded, or project our feelings onto them. So I think that you should consider, you know, also going to therapy. Have you ever gone? And naturally, so I was very dismissive, and I was like, no, and I was like, a little resistant towards it. And then she said, she's like, well, personally, I feel it's unethical to ask your clients to go somewhere that you're not willing to go yourself. And that whole statement was like this aha moment. Like, you're right. Like, how dare I ask my clients to sit in a chair and trust me and confide in me when I can't even do that myself? Mm-hmm. So then I began to go to therapy, and now it helped me to empathize with my clients, to see how it may feel to be on the other end and how they may react. And so now it helps me be a better clinician as well, to be more empathetic to what they're going through and how it must feel to sit and talk to someone about it.
Wow. Because I can imagine myself being like, yeah, no, I'm cool. I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does it change how you interact with even just friends and family?
It does a little bit, because, you know, being in this work of, you're always sitting down and mostly listening, really, is what I do. You know, there's a lot of times where, and we don't really give advice, where my friends want me to give them advice, you know, and then it becomes this balance of, how do I stay as a true friend and help them out with whatever they're going through, but not turn this into a therapy session because there's a conflict of interest. You know, so it does get a little hectic, you know, hard to do that at first. But then at the same time, it's also hard where you start seeing your friends maybe behaving in a way that is alarming to you, that maybe you've recognized from some of your clients talking about
that. But you might not have seen it that way before.
Correct. So then your perspective starts to shift.
So then that's where therapy comes into play?
It does, because it helps me to, number one, to check myself, like, why am I so alarmed by that? Is it about me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or is it about them? You know, and it helps me also to see, well, then how will I talk to them about this? And to make sure that it's coming from a friend place and not the clinical person.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
So this is now your career, what you've been doing it, how long now? It's fairly new, right?
Fairly new, yeah. I graduated a couple months ago in May of 2013. So right now it's been a little bit over 6 months. But while I was in grad school, we had an intern. So I like to say that I had two years and 6 months.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, do you feel like it's a career that you actually can make a decent living off of and support yourself well?
Yeah. At first, we would hear no. We always get these, like, scary stories.
Because, again, that's what my, you know, you're thinking, like, oh, nonprofit, or they're working with these, like, government programs. And you're like, no.
Yeah, and that's why I had a little freak out moment in grad school, and I did like a dual master's versus just a social work master's, because I was like, oh my god, what if financially won't be stable enough? So I'll get my other master's in public health, and maybe I can go into that realm as well. And I was really scared. But you could make a really good, you know, living salary off of social work. You know, our understanding of what social work is, it's very limited. We think it's just sitting and talking, like, just me being a therapist. Mm-hmm. But there's also this element of, when I get my license, I get to mentor someone after a certain amount of time, and then you have to charge for that, or, you know, you tend to charge for that too, because you're supervising someone. It's a liability. But then also, you can, you know, you can be a teacher, you can be a consultant. You know, there's so many things that you could do by just being a social worker, because you understand people, or you do your best to understand people in a very empathetic way, that it really helps you create communication, to create flow effortlessly. And I think that's why a lot of times, you know, I see a lot of social workers begin as social workers, and now they're psychoanalysts, or they're professors, or they're researchers, and, you know, and they're going to different realms. And it's so great to see, you know, how we're using these skills and really developing more out of them.
So how would you define what a social worker is?
I think everyone's a social worker to some extent, you know.
But as far as, like, the career, you know, the people who do it for a career, what would be your definition, I guess, for a social worker?
Oh, that's, like, such a hard way.
You don't have to put it in a box, but, like, yeah, it's just a way to put it into words for somebody who, like, the millions of people like me that are like, so, yeah, the hospital, there's kids, let's put them in a foster home.
Yeah, I mean, it really is just like individuals who seek out to assist others, you know, and in a multitude of ways, whether it's by creating policy change, by working with underserved communities, by developing welfare systems or housing, you know, providing resources, or just sitting down and doing therapy. I think it's just like, it's almost like a media. They're just different medias of doing social work, and it's just a profession that really allows you to expand on how to help people, whether it's on the macro level, meso, or, you know, or so forth. I think it's just, it's a platform. It really is what it is. Social work is like a basic platform to help people.
What's the distinction, though, between a social worker and a therapist? Like the, you know, the, I guess the normal therapist that starts their own profession. What's the difference there?
Well, there's two things. And actually, it's funny because someone yesterday asked me this question. So I'm going to begin by starting off like at the basics. So a social worker is just a social worker, right? But we also have associate clinical social workers and licensed clinical social workers. You know, not everyone that goes into social work wants to be a therapist. There's only a handful of us that want to do that. Mm-hmm. Others may want to do more of program development. Others may want to do something more just like, you know, working with children. So like more case management, you know. So we all have like different aspirations within social work. So we begin as social workers and we choose which route we want to go into. And then we can always bounce back to. We can go, you know, more community-based and then go into, like, you know,
private practice. But is it more school needed to do any of those different variations?
No, it's you just, it's almost like you pick a track within, like, grad school. It depends what school it is. At USC, where I went, you could pick a track. So it really helped you develop which skill sets you want to gain from social work while you're getting your master's. But, you know, once you graduate, you could get a therapist position, given that you register with the Board of Behavioral Sciences and that a licensed social worker is willing to supervise you, almost like serve as your mentor and guide you while you accumulate your hours of experience post-grad and are able to take your licensure exam. So then you, at that point, even though you're an associate, which just means you're gaining your hours, you're considered a therapist.
Gotcha.
And then if you are a licensed therapist, that means you can open up your own private practice. But then we also have PhDs. So people who have a PhD in psychology, that's a psychologist, you know, or if someone's in medical school and specialized in psychiatry, that's a psychiatrist, they prescribe medicine. So essentially a psychologist provides therapy, so can a clinical social worker, an associate social worker. It's just that, you know, the psychologist took their board, you know, got a PhD, took their boards, gained their hours, and now they have their license. You know, whereas for us, we have a master's and we have to build up our hours and so forth to get to the same level as a psychologist. But since they have a PhD, of course, they have a little more, they're a little more reputable because it's a PhD.
But you could get your license and break off and do your own practice just like them?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I could. It just takes a while.
Is that something you would ever contemplate doing?
I'm actually gaining my hours right now.
Mm-hmm. Would you ever want to at some point in the future actually break off? Is that sound appealing to you?
I don't know if I would want to do private practice per se, but I would love to still do aspects of clinical. But I do have this huge, profound love for program development lately, assisting to develop this program for substance abuse that I was referring to earlier. It really helped me to see the change that I wanted to see when I was in high school. When back then all I thought about was politics, to do with politics. Now I was able to really get my hands into this program and help shape it, create a flow. And I really found that rewarding to just now see clients coming in and seeing how there's so many other people that may need other types of services and how this skill set that I just developed could be implemented for that. So I think in the future, I would like to do a little bit of both.
So do you see yourself sticking with this current, is it a program or company?
It's a nonprofit agency.
Okay.
That I'm working for. I can see myself working there for a while, unless I land my ultimate social work dream job, which to many people is like the scariest job.
Which is?
I would love to join a palliative care unit.
What is that? Because I'm like, what?
Most people, when I describe it, they think it's hospice. But it's not hospice. It's before hospice. There's actually, most people don't know that. You don't go straight into hospice. You could go into a thing called palliative care, which is where a person's first diagnosed with a terminal illness. And it's like a team. So there's like a nurse, a doctor, a social worker, and other, it's like an interdisciplinary team. And these are out of hospitals. And they really help the family unit adjust and cope with the new diagnosis or the new stressor that this person and this family is going through. And you help them through this process, you know, and they may have a while to live, but you help them come to peace with what's happening. And it becomes a smoother process. So if they do go to hospice, the family is more prepared for what may occur.
Okay, because I'm just wondering, you're saying it's before hospice. So in my mind, I'm like, how long do these people actually spend time with you?
They can spend up to a year.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, up to like a year. Because hospice is supposed to be like 6 months or less. Otherwise, palliative care is like a year or 8 months. It's really more like prep.
So why are you drawn to that?
Well, to many people, it's like a horror story. But to me, it's, you know, more of a strength, I feel. You know, when I was in college, my cousin, who was like a sister to me, drowned, and she passed away. And we went to the hospital to, you know, to see her body. And I noticed how my entire immediate family was just like a mess in this room, trying to deal with what just happened, this tragedy. And myself, I was not doing well during that time. I was really upset, angry. And I remember the doctor trying to help out and trying to assist, and a social worker there trying to help out as well. But it was overwhelming for them. There was like more than 20 people in this room. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and everything was just chaos. And, you know, and to me, you know, I was so close to my cousin, who I see like a sister, you know, and I kind of wanted to almost pay tribute to her life. And her life was a lot of giving. It was a lot of understanding and a lot of selflessness. And to me, I feel that had there been someone there at that room that probably could have, you know, helped stabilize the situation, maybe things could have gone a little bit smoother, you know. And I feel like there's a lot of families and individuals out there who receive terrible news and they don't have someone there to be able to process that with. They don't have someone there who can really stay with them during that hard time and to get them to a better place. And I feel that so many people are afraid of that, of this whole death concept, mm-hmm. which I am too to some extent, but I feel that at least talking about it, at least being able to normalize someone's life and validate what they're going through, it means a lot. And to show them that you're still going to be there, that you're not going to freak out like most people, I think just is such a valuable experience.
That's powerful, though. So it sounds like it's from this experience that it kind of... Would you say that it really was a big pushing factor towards what you ended up doing?
Yeah, I definitely think that her passing motivated me to be a social worker to many extents, because, you know, she was a social worker from, like, the get-go. She mm-hmm. was always wanting to make people smile and make people feel better, and I think that's part of what I like about social work, is that I get to go home, and even though if I hear, like, the worst story, worst-case scenario, I get to go home and feel good about being able to stay there with this person and to at least try to make them feel better. Even if I didn't, know that I tried.
So when... Are you there, like, this, you know, when the doctor... And again, this is me talking about what I see in a movie uh-huh. or a TV show. The doctor comes out and they're like, we're sorry, so-and-so didn't make it. Mm-hmm. Are you usually there? I mean, or I guess you're not because you're not in the hospital, mm-hmm. but, like, a social worker in that situation, would they be there with the doctor? Or how does that...
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what, at that point, what do they do? Are they literally just the ear to listen at that point?
Mm-hmm. It depends. I mean, every hospital is a different structure. I've seen different approaches, but usually, if someone passes away, the doctor is the only person who can deliver that news. Mm-hmm. From my understanding, it's only a doctor who can actually say that. Now, if they do bring in a social worker, I think it would be wonderful if they do. They usually tend to bring in a licensed person, is from what I'm told, that's who they would bring in. But yeah, you go in there with that family, and as that family is just crying, there's different approaches to help that family, you know, maybe that family at that point may not want to speak. There's different levels of stages of grief, as we call them. And but if they do want to talk, you can help them process what happened and to normalize what they're going through and to validate their experience and to let them know that it's okay to feel whatever they feel. You know, that is their experience. And yeah, you just tend to listen to them a lot and to almost like nurturing and you hold their feelings for them, because right at that moment it's a little bit difficult for them to hold it themselves.
Do you experience any of these situations though where you work?
People come in with a lot of trauma about, you know, people always make that joke about childhood, but yeah, there's a lot of childhood trauma, you know. And what people don't understand is sometimes whatever happens to you in your childhood or whatever things you were not able to properly adjust or cope with, sometimes it manifests into our adult life, you know, and you start seeing that's how we, our relationships are with other people. That's how we treat others are based on these like early experiences, I feel. And, so I see a lot of people whose parents passed away and didn't have, they didn't know how to cope with this. So they developed what we call like maladaptive coping skills, drinking, smoking, drugs. You know, all of those are just utensils for them to cope and make sense of what's happening or to numb what just happened because it's so unbearable for them, you know. And a lot of times I hear a lot of things like that, you know. And only because when my sister passed away, you know, I didn't take that approach, it doesn't mean that other people won't. But that doesn't make my experience any better than their experience. It just makes it their experience and mine. That's all it makes it.
So do you, and you said you basically listen, it's not so much giving them advice. What is your approach to when somebody's unloading all this stuff on you?
I do, well, there's different interventions that you do. You listen a lot, but you also reflect what they're feeling, you know. And for example, it sounds really silly, you know, when I explain it to you, but in the actual therapeutic setting, it's really powerful. One of the things that we do is we call it reflective listening. So if you tell me something, so it could be anything in terms of, let me ask, what did you eat today for breakfast?
Nothing.
Okay, so you didn't eat anything for breakfast today?
No.
You know, it's like...
So you're, okay.
So like in that instance, I reflected what you said, right? And in that instance, since you said, oh, it's nothing... You know, I could ask you, like, well, what would you like to eat? And you would say...
So are you just trying to get them to keep conversing? Is that what it is? Or
you do, but it's...
Or thinking about it.
Is you get them to really think about what it is, but you do it... Obviously, now like, I'm not in the state of mind to totally do therapy, but you do it in a way where it doesn't sound like you're just repeating what they're saying, but it's more like you're reading into what they're saying, and then you reflect it in a way that kind of captures what they say. And at times, you can capture it in a way that they didn't conceptualize it.
Got it.
And then that's where, like...
So then they're hearing what they actually said.
Uh-huh. All right. Yeah. So you can do that a lot. It's kind of reflect what they say, but almost give them, a different wording. So, you know... Yeah, so you do that, or, you know... You give them silence, and sometimes people don't like that, and you see...
Well, I have a friend who all, like blah, 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 silence, and I'm like, oh, I'm like, could you say something, like, in my head, I'm like, say something back, could you ask me a question back, silence, like, I would die, I can't handle that. So do you, why would you do that, though?
Well, there's many reasons. One of them is to allow them to feel what they're feeling. You know, if silence makes someone uncomfortable, then you allow them to feel that, you know, and then they might say, like, you know, why aren't you saying anything? And be like, you know, well, what happens if I don't? Like, what happens then? And then people may be like, well, I just get really uncomfortable. Why is that? So you're able to really explore what's going on. We're not in therapy. We're not avoiding anything anymore. We're taking the bandages off. We're trying to see why this, why that.
But if somebody, do people go like, so what should I do? Can you reply with what they should do, or can you not really answer questions like that?
I mean, there's different styles of therapy. I mean, if you see one therapist today and one tomorrow, you'll see that there's a complete difference.
So there's not necessarily a right or wrong?
There isn't a right or wrong. The way that I was trained was I don't necessarily give a suggestion, but I help them figure out a suggestion for themselves. So if they ask me, what would you do? And I would sometimes just say, well, you know, let's talk about it. What did you do?
Mm.
You know, what would you, and, you know, and to see what happens if you, like, you know, they say, well, I wish I did this, you know, but then I feel bad. So we explore both pros and cons. And at the end, I'm like, well, which one would you feel more comfortable with? Because at the end, it's not about what I think, because it's not my experience. It's what they think.
How do you not take all this home with you every night?
It's hard at first to carry someone's emotions and traumas and then go home and not, you know, and go drink
yourself.
How
do you, like, just not think? Is there a way, have you, like, been able to wipe it from your head now when you go home?
Yeah, you know, I have. Going to therapy really helps, you know, for one. But also just knowing that, like, when you're at work, you're at work. You know, whatever happened during that session, you'll have another chance. There'll be another time.
Mm-hmm.
They'll come back. And if they don't, you did what you thought was best during that session. You know, and a lot of times people get frustrated because they want to see change in others. When you take a step back and you think about it, well, if I'm frustrated because they're not changing, then that's really not about them. That's about me. That's my own problem.
Mm-hmm.
So then if you just start, you know, reflecting everything that they say and make the session really about them, then when that session ends, then that everything that just happened stays in that room. And when they walk out, they have new tools, new perspectives, and that's it. It was never about me from the beginning. So why should I personalize it now?
I just so much in normal day life, I imagine, like, I just, when I'm talking to certain friends and they tell mm-hmm. me stuff, I'm like, oh my God. And I'm like, is my reaction to that me or is that them? But you have to do that every day. How many people do you see a day?
It varies. Tomorrow I'm seeing 6 people.
Is that an average or is that more than average?
That's actually a little more than average. I like to see at least 4 people a day.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of documentation we have to do after we see a client. And sometimes they need resources, so they need time to also, like, you know, research that and provide them with appropriate resources that they may need.
What's the percentage of actually interacting with people to paperwork?
In all honesty, more paperwork than seeing people, sadly.
Gosh.
Mm-hmm.
So that part that you see in TV shows is true.
Yes, that part is true, yes. That's what I think. It's harder to leave that at work, the paperwork, because paperwork follows you. That is hard to leave at
home.
Did
they prepare you for that in school, you think, accurately? Like, did you know coming in, like, yep, I'm going to have tons of paperwork to do?
They didn't tell me that, but now that I think about it, that's why, like, every couple weeks I had, like, papers due, and there were, like, long papers and these crazy deadlines. Like, now I kind of understand why they did it, because that's what it is in the real world. The only thing that was different is we were going to school twice a week and interning twice a week. So we're doing like 20 hours, 20.
Okay.
You know, whereas now it's 40 and you're seeing more clients and different agencies have different structures. Some agencies, it's normal for you to have a caseload of 20. Others, it's normal to have a caseload of 30. You know, everything varies and every place is funded differently. So depending who you're funded by, you may have more or less paperwork than the average social worker.
Do you feel like there are enough social workers actually in the profession? Do they need more?
You know, it depends. Here in LA, I think we have a lot because we have so many universities that offer this program
mm-hmm.
that we almost become oversaturated and then we end up fighting with each other for jobs, you know? And I think that's why here it may be oversaturated, but at the same time, we have a high burnout rate. So I guess it kind of replenishes itself if you think about it. I think we need more social workers that are in this for the common good of others.
What do you mean? Do you see them in there for a different reason?
Sometimes I see people that go into social work because in grad school I saw a couple that were kind of lost. And this kind of seemed like a noble thing, is what they would say.
Okay.
But they would get uncomfortable when they had to interact with a different community that they've never known before. You know, and at USC, they do something that's great. The week before you start school, they give you a location of a community in Los Angeles that you have to go explore and write this detailed paper about. And a lot of times, it's a community that you may not know nothing about. I had to go to Wilshire and Fairfax, I believe, or Fairfax and La Brea, sorry, for Fairfax and La Brea.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So there was, like, mm-hmm. this, you know, huge Jewish community. There was also an Armenian community, Russian mm-hmm. community. And I know nothing about, you know, either of those communities, but I had to go and immerse myself in the, you know, with this community, go into, you know, bakeries and ask them about, like, you know, what is their, you know, daily life? And then see how many of them were afraid to even speak to me. You know,
were because... They, are you the cops? Like, what?
Yeah, they thought I was a cop, or, like, who are you? And I'm like, no, I'm a student, and that didn't even fly over very well. But I think that in itself just teaches you that if you can find passion in that, to be able to go into such a foreign experience and to make something positive, I think that is what we need. We need social workers like that. Because we're going to always be in situations where you're not going to... This is a new situation. Like, you're going to have a client that doesn't tell you a story that blows your mind, that you think only happens in movies, and then what then?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you are going to go in this for the common good of other people, and to be okay with dysfunction, about hearing people in these crazy stories, but really just wanting to help them, that's what we need. You know, not the ones that we see in the television that are like these jaded burnout social workers that are like taking kids out of the home. And no, like that, you do see that sometimes. You run into those social workers and it's disheartening, but I think we need more of the other ones.
Is there an equal representation? I mean, you know, you get thrown into asked to go to these different communities. Mm-hmm. Are there enough people you think that represent all these different communities that can interact with them?
No, I don't.
So are you a rarity, or are you like a minority, I guess, rather, within...
Within social work, I'm actually not a minority. Hmm. My grad program was, I think, 600 people, and the majority of us were Latinos.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know why that surprises me.
You know, seriously, and this may sound like such like a mean comment to say, and so I hope this is not misinterpreted, but when I was an undergrad, when I went to psychology courses... And this could have been, like, geographically, you know, mm-hmm. because I was in, you know, Northern California where I was. Maybe there's more Caucasian people. But most of the people in my classes were Caucasian in my psychology courses.
Well, I'm going to agree with that's basically what you run into up there.
Yeah. And then when I went to my sociology classes, that was my minor, it was so diversified. And when I went into grad school for social work, it was the same concept, diversified. You know, and when I go into, when I did my master's in public health, it was not diversified.
Mm.
So I think in certain professions, we tend to get certain demographics. And social work happens to be one where it's a very diverse, it's a very, very diverse profession. But even now in the field, I tend to see a lot of Latino social workers. But then again, I'm in LA, and that could just be demographics, yeah, you know.
And that's good for LA at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because many people that can speak Spanish, but at the same time, not only people who speak Spanish need social services. I mean, everyone needs social services at mm-hmm. one point. So I think we do need more people who speak other languages. Because LA is such a big melting pot that we need people who can speak Mandarin, who can speak, you know, I don't even know what, like Lebanese. I mean, we need everything, really. So I think in that concept, I haven't seen many people who are, you know... Armenian in the program.
What happens with situations like that, though, when you have somebody who does not speak a language that any of you guys speak? Have you run across that?
Yeah, I have, and it's so unfortunate, and that's why sometimes I feel like I resort to, you know, speaking sign language that's made up by me. Like, what do I think that they may, if I do this mm-hmm. with my hands, will they understand? And so you kind of go back to, like, caveman, like, prehistoric times, like, making sounds and gestures and drawing things, you know, and seeing if that's what they need. You have to get really creative, you know, but you can still help people, even if, because you'll even have someone who comes in and maybe they don't speak, and all they speak is, you know, sign language, and maybe it's not even American Sign Language, so you have to just know how to communicate.
There's so many, does that make you want to learn all these different languages? How would you even do that?
I don't know, I think I need
like
to
stop
myself.
Like, if you were to pick one other language or form of communication, what mm-hmm. would you pick next?
American Sign Language.
Yeah, I think that would probably mm-hmm. be a...
That would definitely be it.
You come across that a lot?
I don't. To be honest with you, I really don't. But I feel that that would be a profound language to learn. Because I think that's another population that's so misunderstood. Or not even known, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you never really... I'm proud to say that in my grad program, we had one female who was in our program who was from a foreign country and only spoke in sign language. And it was the most empowering thing to see that I did not speak a word of her language, and yet I just sat there with her and used hand signals, and we were able to get something across, you know. And she would teach me how to say, like, I remember you. Like, she had someone that would, an aide,
mm-hmm.
and they would, like, help me understand and teach me a couple of things. And, to me, it was just a very profound moment to just be able to have that experience of not being able to use voice to communicate. And I think that was just a very teaching moment.
So where do you see yourself, or where do you hope to see yourself in 5 years?
Oh, yeah. I actually want to eventually get my PhD.
More school.
I know.
More money.
More money that I don't have, because it's all going to school.
Well, I have, if you want to sleep on my patio.
Ah, I was actually thinking more like to sleep on this couch.
Oh, well, yeah, I could be nice and do that.
Right, you know?
So, PhD.
Yeah.
How many more years, though? How does that equate to where you are right now with your schooling?
I don't know, because it depends what field I go into. I'm still debating, but it would probably be 5 years, because I could do a PsyD,
What was that?
A PsyD is a PhD without the research component. I mean, there's less of that. Whereas in PhD, you have to do a dissertation, less research,
Well, I feel if you're going to go through that at all, you might as well just go all the way for the gold.
I feel the same way. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it, and research it. And since I have, this passion, and I'm very loquacious, as most of y'all can tell, and I think it's good to put that into work, and to research something that I don't know.
Wow, more school. Mm-hmm. We're good for you. When would you have to make that decision? I mean, I guess you could choose that at any time, mm-hmm. but is there a certain track of you'd want to do this at a certain time in your career?
Yeah, I first want to focus on getting licensed. I think that's my goal.
And how close or far are you from that?
I think it's a long process. We have to accumulate 3,200 hours of clinical therapy. It can be broken up, mm-hmm. Into, case management, but the majority, the bulk of it is face to face. And then you get to take a 2-part test after you're done with all your hours. But it's just a long, long process. It takes people 4 years or 5 sometimes. Because, it's the BBS is I believe it's small. Because when you apply for your associate number, it takes 3 months to even hear back from them.
Mm.
So I'm assuming they're relatively small. And, small in that sense, And then to process all that paperwork. So I think it just takes a long time.
So in 5 years, you'll be starting towards your PhD, hopefully. Is that what...
Yeah. I think it's good to have goals,
but to be open to... It could change.
Yeah, exactly. I may not get my PhD, and I'll be okay with that. But if I do, then I do.
Thank you for explaining this a little more to me. Because I have so many friends that do so many different things, and I'm I barely know about what they really do. And you're oh, yeah, that's what you do?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's I'm an actuary. I'm something with numbers.
I believe there's a calculator involved.
Well, thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing you sleep on my couch in 5 years.
Yay. And I'm sorry for talking so much, but we rarely get to be talkers.
You guys can now hear this noise. We are...
Oh. Water.
Green beer. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.